Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters, overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. It's time to talk about horror heroes, or rather, anti-heroes. It started in the teens, the 19-teens, with monsters that crept across the silver screen before they could speak. Lon Chaney was the first movie star identified almost exclusively with the horror genre. As the titular character in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Phantom of the Opera, and numerous other such memorable roles, all of which he created his own makeup for, his popularity as a player of monsters was so strong that there was a common joke among the populace. Don't step on it, it might be Lon Chaney. Chaney surely would have made the transition to talkies had throat cancer not robbed us of his brilliance in 1930. The 1930s introduced a vast array of horror stars who brought life to the undead. Boris Karloff as Frankenstein's monster and the mummy, Bela Lugosi as Count Dracula and the broken-necked Igor, and Chaney's own son, Creighton, who was christened Lon Jr. by Universal to capitalize on the popularity of his father. There were many who made their bones as horror stars throughout the decades of fright films. The Brits had Christopher Lee, who played every monster that Hammer Studios threw at him, Count Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, The Mummy, and way, way more. And of course, Anthony Perkins made an indelible mark as Norman Bates in the Psycho movies. But from the 1970s through today, there haven't been nearly so many actors identified as horror icons. Heroes, and especially heroines, yes, but actors who achieve fame through their portrayals of fiends, not so much. When the smoke clears, there is one who stands alone among them, a great and trained dramatic artist who found success in films and television beginning in the mid-70s. But it was when Wes Craven cast him as Freddy Krueger in 1984 in A Nightmare on Elm Street that Robert Englund became an international icon of terror. Such an icon, in fact, that a new documentary all about Englund has just been released to theaters and Screambox. It was a long road that led from Buster and Billy to Hollywood Dreams and Nightmares, the Robert Englund story. Let's take that trip with the talented and versatile Robert Englund. So, Robert, you did not start out wanting to be a horror icon. You were a very seriously trained actor who went to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England.
Well, I trained with the faculty, a great faculty from RADA that had taught Albert Finney and Peter O'Toole and Alan Bates and all those actors that we know of and love. But I came back to America because I wasn't able to sustain it as a kind of a deferment from the draft. And I didn't want to get my ass shot off in Vietnam. And I was lucky that many of the faculty took over a theater in the Midwest, the Meadowbrook Theater. So I was able to complete all of my training there and then work at the professional theater at night, you know, mopping the stage and being an understudy since that was, gosh, we're talking now 1968.
Well, your dad was an engineer at Lockheed, where my dad also worked as a draftsman, pretty close to the same time. So that's a very left brain, right brain family thing. Something, an engineer is very specific and very hardwired, whereas the looseness and creativity involved in acting is something that uses quite another discipline altogether. Was there resistance to the direction you took in your family, or was there encouragement?
There was resistance. I mean, you know, a lot of people make now think of you as this raconteur and perhaps a writer, but I mean, I think of you always as a director, and I know you're using a lot of the science that's in your DNA, but it never got in me, you know? And I, my revelation was my father, when I was in these advanced placement classes, not because I'm incredibly smart, but because I had tested off the charts for reading comprehension. So they pushed me ahead in school a half a grade. And my father would hover over me when I was in, I remember pre-algebra, I think, factoring, I think it was. And I hit the wall so hard with that stuff. And of course, my father could just stand there, you know, with a martini in his hand, glancing away and his skinny tie like and his vest that Ed Harris wore in the right stuff and just do it all in his head. And I knew I had none of that sensibility or intellect about me. It was really frustrating. And I think it was a bit frustrating for my father, too, that I just wasn't equipped with that, you know. But eventually he saw the family name, Single Frame, my very first movie, fourth billing, single card. And I kept the family name, as strange as it is, with a U instead of an A, England. And he was so proud of it, you know, that he was, you know, I had him in the palm of my hand from then on.
That's so great. Now, I remember 1974 going to the El Cajon Theater and seeing Buster and Billy and being really impressed. I remember you very well from that movie. You really made an impression. And it
was. I got a good review in Time magazine. In fact, one of my reviews thought that Daniel Petri, the director who had, you know, the whitest man in the world from Canada, he directed, you know, the great Lorraine Hansberry, Raisin in the Sun. With Sidney Poitier and everyone starting out, all the great, great Black actors in America were in that film. And so that was my first audition, a movie audition, and I nailed it, you know. And Buster and Billy, it had good reviews, but some people thought that Daniel had gone out and with a butterfly net or something and found some little kid with a banjo, like the boy from
Deliverance.
Deliverance, you know, and put him in a movie, you know, and I took that as a compliment, but I was typed for quite a while as the Southern sidekick, you know, the Southern best friend, the buddy, the pal for a while. So when people get worried about me chafing at the horror bit, they forget that for, you know, for 5 or 6 years, I was sort of the go-to redneck.
And the irony of that is you're from Glendale, California. You're from Southern California.
Well, you know, I spent a little bit of time in England, and because I spent years working with Englishmen that came down from Stratford, Ontario, the theater there, and that came from New York and came from London. I actually did the Boyfriend, the musical that launched Julie Andrews. I actually did that with the original cast of all the young people who had turned old. So they did all the older roles. And of course, I was one of the younger people in the cast, but I got all of those stories. But I was around the Brits all the time. At the Meadowbrook Theater, north of Detroit, it was on the edge of the Matilda Dodge estate. And that's Dodge like cars.
Right.
I mean, and they had a screening room with hand-signed tiles by Charlie Chaplin and Orson Welles and people like that. The largest indoor horse riding rink in the world, bigger than, you know, the Disney movie Lippenstaller.
The Lippenstaller,
Annette Funicello on horseback, you know, there's a fantasy. But anyway, and so we would go to the pub at night, all of us, you know, spear carriers and extras and understudies and scenery movers. And I, of course, I was mopping the floor and among other things. And but we would go over there and they would regale us with tales, you know, about who took care of Albert Finney's pregnancies and who fixed Peter O'Toole's wife's teeth and who was extraordinary and who wasn't and great failures and even, you know, stories about Olivier's flops as well as, and we would just sit around, you know, like, you know, kids listening to campfire stories, you know, and of course they all of the RADA faculty wanted to smoke marijuana and drink, you know, Italian wines with all of us, you know, and we just wanted to wear turtlenecks and jackets with patches on the sleeve and beat them. So it was this sort of great moment of transfer between these wonderful seasoned stage veterans from West End and repertory theater in London, the Royal Shakespeare Company among them. And then all of us young American actors from all over America and Canada who'd managed to audition and been accepted.
Well, what an extraordinary time and experience. But it leads me to the question about, you studied and trained in theater, classical theater and modern theater, and the difference between performing for a stage and performing for a camera where you're hitting your marks. It's a very technical thing, and yet you have to not be caught acting. The camera is so intimate. And tell me how it felt the first time you did film after having been so seasoned in the theater.
Well, for me, it was baptism by fire because I had a starring role with, what, back in 1973, arguably one of the biggest stars in the American cinema. Dick Clayton had let all of his client list go and kept two kids, two young guys. One was Burt Reynolds, who'd been, you know, evicted from the Universal contract system along with Clint Eastwood. And the other one was Jan Michael Vincent. Mm-hmm. And people forget just how big Jan was. You know, people forget about great films like White Line Fever, you know, and Bite the Bullet, and The Mechanic with Charles Bronson, along with you know, one of the films I starred with him in, Buster and Billy. But I was wearing very primitive special effect contacts, and they were pink, and they were made in Beverly Hills. And I went several times to Beverly Hills to have them fitted, and I'd never worn contacts before. And I got on location, and I was down there in Statesboro, Georgia, the land of the Allman Brothers, you know, eat a peach. And and with all that humidity and mosquitoes and, you know, of course, working nights, they turn those Klieg lights on, they turn the 10Ks on, and every bug, you know, in Georgia wakes up and circles. And if you're anywhere near that, you've got them up your nose, your mouth, your ears, and any other orifice that might be exposed. And it was driving me nuts. And these primitive contact lenses, it's 1973 now, and they're colored. They felt like that old children's book, you know, with the dog who had eyes as big as saucers. It literally felt like I had saucers in my eyes. And on the very first evening of shooting, I went up to Daniel Petrie and I said, Dan, I said, you know, these are driving me nuts. All I can think about are these goddamn contacts. My eyes are watering. I have to tilt my head back because otherwise gravity's making me really look down low just because they feel so uncomfortable. And he said, Robert, take them out. We don't need them. He goes, the eyes are the windows of the soul. And actually, I had a little science on my side. My eyes are pale green. And if you put green and red together, you get brown. And the contacts were pinkish red. And so I just squinted a lot, you know, and kind of put to squint with my Georgia accent. And the squint and the accent together, it seemed to kind of meld, and I got away with it, you know, because I was playing an albino who was ashamed of being an albino and who literally dyed his hair black with shoe polish.
Right.
So I think that part of that backstory was cut out of the film, you know, but maybe Jan Michaels says it at one point. But there was a whole scene where you saw me, you know, with my toothbrush, putting, you know, blacking my hair up. But that moment from Daniel Petrie saying, "The eyes are the windows of the soul," and just walking away and leaving this young kid, I was 24 years old, I think, you know, leaving me there, you know, in my period wardrobe, you know, squinting away and trying to feel secure with this sort of Southern Georgian accent. It was such a boost of confidence. And in the documentary and in my book, I try to mention all the times I can remember getting those wonderful moments of approval and confidence from superstars and stuff that were not afraid to tell me, "Go for it, kid, you know, you've got something." And that starts to layer in the back of your head as a kind of foundation of confidence. And that was the one that's just sort of set me free. And I mean, I still learn in front of the camera. You and I've discussed this before. It's that thing it's so intriguing about film work is you're always learning, and it's for posterity, and you're always doing something, and it's print, you know, moving on. and you know, you're driving home on the 405 at 4 a.m. and you go, "Oh, wait a minute. I said that line wrong. Oh, wait, that's what that scene's about. Oh no." And of course it's down forever. You know, this mistake, is why when actors say they don't like watching themselves, that's why, because we see our own misreads, and it might be a misread in a wardrobe choice that was our fault, or it might be a prop we chose that we shouldn't have, or a prop we should have used that we should have fought for, or or just a line reading, you know. And I have famous line readings as Freddie that I misread. And you know, when I go to conventions and things, I share that story, you know, with the fans, so they know that, you know, we all make mistakes, and sometimes it doesn't matter.
Absolutely. And there are some, it takes a village to make a movie, but.
Oh my God.
What a great lesson on your very first time out. You know,
literally my first day of shooting. And, you know, Daniel Petrie, I'll always love him for that, and respect him for having that confidence in me.
But the important thing that's different about working on film is you have to forget there's a camera near you, and there's a group of crew members around that camera. There's the sound boom operator. There's the director sitting next to the monitor or next to the camera. All of these people aware that are right feet away from you, and rather than a proscenium separating you from the audience.
Yeah, it's different. And when you're on a sound stage, it's a little easier because of the lighting. When you're on location, though, you know, there's somebody right there. And when you're doing, you know, any kind of practical effects, which I've done, you know, decades of, you know, you have people just out of frame, you know, dressed in black, that might be putting a hydraulic up your leg while you're trying to say a line cool. And that hurts. But, you know, again, on this original film, my very first film, spring of 73, it's 50 years ago today.
Wow.
I was out on a beach near Cloisters, that wonderful resort where all the golf legends played back in the 20s and 30s and 40s on the South Georgia coast. And it's because it's near a national seashore, it's just pristine there, wild horses on the beach, and Jekyll Island is near there, and Sea Island. It's rather a famous idyllic place. And I was out on the beach doing a shot, and the camera was literally, I mean this, Mick, it was probably a quarter of a mile away.
Wow.
And Jan and I just walked down this wet, sandy beach together. And we started this scene, and Jan was just talking like this, you know, something like, "You know why, you know, who that girl, that Billy, you know, there's just something about her." Just no projection, no attempt at projection. We had our little mics taped to our chests. And I instantly knew why he was doing that. I loved that. I remember just loving that intimacy and the fact that the crew was a quarter of a mile back, you know, filming me from a bluff top, you know, and it was just this romantic shot with the sun going down, you know, of two boys, you know, talking about love, you know, and that I wanted more of that, you know, I wanted more of that. And I think for a long time, and Mick, you remember the 70s, you know, a lot of times the actors would be brought along for the whole project.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't just shoot us up in 48 hours, hand us our paycheck and send us back on a plane, you know, kept us around in case you needed us. And in many times, Lance Hendrickson and I have talked about this, our roles were expanded because people were happy with our work. But you also learned a lot. You watched, you went to work the days you didn't have to work, and you watched them film because you were there for a run of the show. You also liked that free meal. too. But
the magic of movies, and back on that original movie,
I learned so much. You know, I went up in my first helicopter on a Tyler mount, you know, and you'll remember that back in the 70s that we were really fascinated. And our technology was lending itself more and more to location filming. And there's a verisimilitude that comes with being on location that you just can't get anywhere else. Every once in a while, I'll see a really great show and I'll go, yeah, but that's not New York. And I know it's Toronto.
It's Toronto.
That's not London. You know, no, that's not Israel. No, they're not in the Middle East. They're in Morocco, you know.
Or Palm Springs.
And now I'm jaded because I'm an actor and I've worked in all those places. But when you're really in the authentic place, it does kind of infuse the project with a reality that doesn't happen anywhere else.
Well, there is such a magic about the construction of cinema and the fact that, you know, what Peter Bogdanovich calls pieces of time. Mm. You get a good line reading. It doesn't need to be 10 good line readings in a row. You can have magic put together with pieces and different angles that speak their eloquence with different lenses, different colors, changes of the frame, the movement, and just the actors bouncing off one another in ways that they couldn't do in a formal stage setting.
I think that's one of the reasons some directors don't like their actors to go to dailies. Of course, now, you know, with the replay screen, excuse me, on all the sets, which add to the time of shooting, but you can also paint yourself into the frame better. You understand where they, you know, better, and you also are inspired. But I know for a fact that when you go to dailies and rushes back in the day, it's unedited. You know, you just see master after master after master and coverage piece after coverage and close-up after close-up. You don't see the editing. You don't see the other person listening to you. You don't see the other person speaking. Sometimes you don't even hear the other person speaking. And it's very unnatural. And it's bad for an actor, I think, to see you that way. I remember Bob Rafelson told me, you have to be very careful because it can enter your dream state. And I don't want to sound like Freddy Krueger here, but it really can. You can really dream of rushes and dailies, and it can intimidate your acting.
Yeah.
You know, it can make you more vain. It can make you safer, too safe. Mm-hmm. And it can frustrate you because maybe when that scene is assembled and that forlorn locomotive whistle is put in, you know, and the music cues are put in, maybe it's going to be a great scene. And maybe that one line that you hate that you see over and over and over again in dailies won't even be in, the camera won't even be on you then. Maybe the editor will be clever enough to keep it on who's ever speaking or whoever's listening to you.
And it can be misguiding too, because you can see yourself performing a certain way and think that you want to change it or you want to keep doing it that way when...
Yeah, you get self-conscious or you get... Yeah. You say, oh, I look cool there, and you start repeating yourself, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's stick in the 70s for just a little while longer, because you auditioned not only for Luke Skywalker, but also for Han Solo. Tell me a little about that.
You know, it's strange, and I keep trying to set the record straight on this. It's a great story, and I've told it many times and many ways, you know, such as my memory is retained, but I tell this as a once upon a time in Hollywood story. And once upon a time in Hollywood, Robert Englund and his girlfriend, Jan Fisher, who went on to write Lost Boys, and a kid named Mark Hamill all hung out at my wonderful Neutra, a apartment in the Hollywood Hills.
Oh, wow.
Valley side of Studio City.
Right.
R.G. Armstrong lived across the street. Mary Tyler Moore.
I know exactly where that is.
Yes. Wonderful. Yeah. You know, Breakfast at Dupar's. You know exactly where I am. At any rate, I had been begging and pulling hair, trying to get in for Apocalypse Now. I had read the original draft and loved it. Just, you know, loved it. And my agent got me in. And I thought that he had done what I asked him to do, which was to get me in to read for the part of the cookie, the chef, the part right. that the late, great Frederick Forrest played.
Yeah.
But in fact, he didn't. He got me in because he knew I surfed. He got me in for the surfer, the part that one of the Bottoms brothers played. Right. Joe Bottoms, I think, but I may have that name wrong. I know it wasn't him, but I've worked with him. But anyway, so I was too young for the chef, for Cookie. And I think it was Frederick Forrest was a zoetrope contract player then, like Harrison Ford and Cindy Williams. And I think he was already set, you know, because it was going to be a very expensive movie. And they love Freddie's work. And so they let me read for the surfer, but I could tell. And I think somebody said, or I heard somebody say, he's too old. And I had my hair combed back rather severely. And I always have had a high hairline. And so that wasn't a good idea. But I was dressed in thrift shop military gear. And I had on a great old faded military shirt. And I had on a pair of green 501 Levi's that were been washed a million times. And a pair of desert boots, you know, and my buttons were unbuttoned. And I had long blowing hair combed straight back. And somebody in the office, and it may have been Fred Roos or one of his people, took me across the hall to where they're making this space movie. One of our partners is in Zoetrope's making this space movie. And they're having some problems. So they rushed me across the hall, probably to make me feel good, get me out of there, because I wanted so desperately to read, you know, for the Frederick Forrest role in Apocalypse. And I went in there and they took a Polaroid of me, I think, for Han Solo. I vaguely remember they were having a problem with that role at the time. And it may have been that somebody had turned it down. And I don't know. There's all sorts of stories out there. Tom Selleck and lots of stories. I don't know. But I know I heard somebody say that originally they had wanted Han to be like that cool uncle that comes around for the holidays, you know, and gets you high in the backyard with a joint. And they wanted him older, considerably older than Luke. And that wasn't me. I was pretty close to Luke in age. And in fact, I was going up against Billy Capp for a lot of roles in those days. And I think Billy was right down to the wire for Luke Skywalker with Mark.
And this was right after he had done Carrie. So
they took my photo with a Polaroid, and I knew I didn't have a chance. But as I exited the office, I glanced down and I saw the sides, the audition script for this character called Luke Skywalker. And I just remember reading the name, Luke Skywalker. Well, I mean, it's cool. It could be a gunslinger. You know, it could be a Native American played by Charles Bronson in a politically incorrect Western, you know. Just such a cool name. You know, one of those great names in the entire history of cinema. And I glanced at the sides. I went across the street and had an old Bushmills at the Formosa, and got in my beat up Datsun 2000 and drove up Laurel Canyon and over Laurel Canyon and went home. It's about 4 in the afternoon. There's a pair of Acme boots on my front porch. I opened the door and there's Mark Hamill sprawled out with a Heineken on my couch, actually a mattress with a futon cover on it, you know, watching my Trinitron. I had managed to save up enough money for a Trinitron with it, a residual or something. At any rate, and I think I told Mark about it, you know, Luke Skywalker, because we both idolized George Lucas. I think at that time, American Graffiti was both Mark and my favorite films. Mm. And Mark got on the horn, called his agent. Now, his agent gets upset when I tell this story because she insists that she'd already submitted him for the role, and she could have. She may have. I don't know. I just know that Mark heard it from me. because he got on the phone and called his agent. So the once upon a time in Hollywood is that once upon a time in Hollywood, the guy that would go on to play Luke Skywalker, the guy that would go on to play Freddy Krueger, the girl that would go on to write Lost Boys, all were, you know, eating peanut butter and jelly, you know, and living in the mouth of the canyon on the valley side, you know, and surviving and watching reruns of Mary Tyler Moore and listening to records of Monty Python and Lenny Bruce and sharing information with each other, which is what we did in those days. It was kind of like when I first started surfing, you know, surfers would all wave to themselves because we were all venturing further north or further down into Mexico. And you'd always share some great beach that you found or some break that you just discovered with us. This is before there was too many of us, you know, and you started to hate seeing surfboards sticking out of the back of a station wagon. But actors were very generous with each other back then. You know, we were like always share, hey, there's a part you might be right for, or there's some, you know, and that's the story. But I was never up for Luke or for Han. No, it was Apocalypse Now that I was trying very desperately to get in.
Okay,
that's cool. Very similar to this one. You must have,
okay, we've cleared up the legend of Star Wars and Robert Englund is now clear.
Yes. Don't believe what you read on the internet.
All right. That's a lesson to us all, especially me. But I'd love to talk about your affiliation with Tobe Hooper, starting with Eaten Alive, because it's such a fruitful collaboration that led to The Mangler and then later to our Masters of Horror episode and the like. Tell me about the experience of meeting and working with Tobe for the first time.
Well, I'm trying to remember if I had to audition or whether that was an offer, because I was really strong in those kind of roles. Now, that was my first cowboy, but I think I kind of remember going out somewhere in North Hollywood for the audition. I think I'm right about that. And meeting Tobe, and he had his Sherman. There was always a Sherman in his fingers, you know, that cigarello, you know, right out of a Sergio Leone film. And he barked every, kind of, you know, Tobe can't talk like this.
Yeah.
And it was, and you could hear a little bit of the Texas in there if you had an ear like an actor. And my memory is walking on the soundstage and being so blown away by a three-story, it was at the old Raleigh Studios across the street from Paramount, you know, kind of behind the Esquire Revival Theater there. And I remember, and it was still the original old lot in Hollywood in those days, you know, just, you know, with little teeny shingles literally hanging out over the writers' rooms and things. And walking on the soundstage, and there was this three-story Victorian house, incredibly lit. And there were tumbleweeds, and my car, which was a two-door Cadillac Eldorado, and I underlined two-door because that's what makes it cool. And there was cages on the veranda of this old Victorian, you know, Texas house, you know, kind of like a rundown miniature of the home in Giant. And we know how great George Stevens framed that and used that as a look. And in the cages, there were monkeys and there were Gila monsters, you know, and lizards and an old bird, you know, and they were squawking away. And then there was this row of director's chairs. And I love William Findlay. He's one of my favorite actors of all time. I think he does the greatest mad doctor in the history of film in Brian De Palma's Sisters. So William Findlay's sitting there. Mel Ferrer, who may have still been married at that time to Audrey Hepburn, was there. Carolyn Jones, who doesn't love Carolyn Jones? You know, she's an Oscar winner.
Morticia.
The great Neville Brand, my mother was a huge fan of Neville Brand's, and as a child had turned me on to live Playhouse 90 kind of programming where Neville Brand was a guest star, or Lee Marvin, or she also loved, it was a very young Ricardo Montalban back in those days. I remember there was one where Lee Marvin and Ricardo Montalban got in kind of like a modern jiu-jitsu kind of fight. in a locker room or something. And it was like a, you know, one of those quality Studio One or whatever those shows were called back then. So I knew who Neville Brand was. And in fact, somebody in college had turned me on to a great kind of cinema verite film that Neville Brand had done about where he played a Navy chief, kind of heroic and kind of a boys movie. So I knew him from Westerns and everything. And Neville was there, and I was all, had always been impressed by Neville, even though he was chewing scenery a bit for Toby. But he should have. It was a horror movie. It was a melodrama. And Marilyn Burns from Texas Chainsaw Massacre was sitting there, and it was just this extraordinary cast. Stuart Whitman, you know, and of course, Stuart Whitman, I idolized him from Sands of the Kalahari, you know, right, running around with a perspiring Susanna York, you know, wearing nothing but a pair of cutoffs and fighting giant chimps, you know, speaking of boys' adventure films. And I don't know what was more dangerous, the chimps or Stanley Baker in that film. But anyway, it was just blown away because I knew all of these actors since childhood, you know, and I had to come in and act with all of them, you know. And so that's my entrance into Eaten Alive. And of course, Toby almost instantly took me under his wing and we just hit it off. And you are maybe closer to Toby than I ever was. I've done, I think, 4 movies with Toby, but yeah. Toby could talk about anything. Yeah. Like John Carpenter, you know, Toby would talk about rock and roll and Texas blues, and you get him talking about Motown or Stax Records or, yeah. And Toby knew history. I remember being with Toby in Israel and it was called a prayer, Arab called a prayer. And we were at a place called Benny the Fisherman's, and they put a pitcher of lemonade in front of us, 3-1. If you remember all the fad with the Russian vodkas back in the 80s, it was that pepper vodka. And Toby's then girlfriend, I believe she was an editor. And Toby looks out at the reef. And then he makes a phone call. And then he comes back to the table and he tells us this whole Greek legend about Andromache and this reef that we can see boiling, you know, 50. I'm looking at it to see if there's going to be any waves breaking, you know, as I get drunk on vodka and lemonade. And Toby, he knows we're at some famous historical spot that like plays in often Greek and Roman legend, you know, and that happened to me with Toby on a dozen occasions, you know. And I think I'm not sure, but I think he and my wife Nancy were together just on a field trip in Israel, up north of Tel Aviv on the coast, and found some incredible crusader town. And I think Toby knew all about it, you know, and all these horror stories about the crusades and what evil they wrought historically, you know, for Western civilization. But, you know, he just an amazing guy. And, you know, I still haven't dealt with Toby's passing. You know,
yeah, it's a rough one. We were very,
I mean, I've dealt with Wes's more because Wes and I share more friends in common. So yeah. I've grieved, I've shared the grief with friends, mutual friends of Wes's and mine. But Toby, I was just so surprised. And, you know, it just came out of left field, you know, yeah. Because I had just been talking to him about some television stuff.
Nobody expected it. And I know you did that. You did The Mangler with him. You did Masters of Horror with him. And you did the first episode of Freddy's Nightmares with him. And just over the years, just.
Well, Masters of Horror was such fun.
Yeah.
And it was such a good cast. Jonathan Tucker's amazing. Mm-hmm. And but I remember I had to kill this older woman in it.
Yes, you did.
And I remember Toby pulling me off her and straddling her. And she's like this phenomenal actress from Canada, you know, veteran woman, character actress. And Toby's on top of her and she's going with it. You know, she's right. She loves it because she's doing her horror movie. And Toby's just screaming, "More blood. I need some more blood over here." You know, and
exhaling, you know,
from his cigarillo. And he's painting blood on her. way deep in her hair. And it's and he walks back and he puts me back on her and says, action. And I shake her a little bit. And as I shake her, the blood just perfectly drops out of her scalp. You know? And I know Toby's, you know, loving it. He's just, he's like a little boy. But it's so funny, you know, he's such a good actor. And I always have to defend Poltergeist. Yes. Because knowing Toby as well as I do, yeah, that's a Toby Hooper film. And I know Steven Spielberg contributed a lot to that. Yeah. And he was up to his eyes working with ILM on that.
Yeah, you know? And I was on the set. I was doing publicity on the film. So I can assure you that your assumptions are correct.
But I know, I mean, what all, you know, that great relationship between Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams and Smoke and Dope and all of that, that's Toby. You know, he found that thing. And, you know, I knew the girl. She was in V with me. The young lady that was murdered by the sauce chef, the sous chef. And, you know, and that was a great, great hole in all of our hearts.
Dominique.
And when we were working on V, and she had stories, you know, Poltergeist stories, and loved Toby, you know, and we had that in common. That was our icebreaker, that Dominique and I had both worked with Toby.
Well, Toby was kind of your entree into the horror genre, even before Wes.
That's my first horror movie. And I didn't even think of it as a horror movie. I don't know why. I had this strange sort of, I'd paired David Lynch, Toby, and Wes together.
Yeah.
On some kind of avant-garde, cruel, push the envelope filmmakers. And of course, they are, Hobie is a consummate horror film director, and quite possibly not only influential, but, and I'm going to say this kindly now, without saying any names, but certainly Texas Chainsaw Massacre is one of the most borrowed from films ever made. And we can say that about Jaws, and we can say that about Sergio Leone films. Sure. And we can say that about some sequences in Peckinpah and Hitchcock, obviously.
Yep.
But there's stuff in Texas Chainsaw Massacres that appears in every movie made still, you know, and it happened there first.
And nobody has outdone it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you get something happens in your stomach, it tightens, and there's a relentlessness to it. But there's also a strange, peculiar horizon of horror joy in that.
Yeah,
I don't know how else to describe it.
Well, there's a what I call red humor. It's it's way darker than black humor.
Mm.
And Toby was the master of that, particularly in Chainsaw 2.
There's a film I just saw in my healing process from COVID, going down the rabbit holes of screamers. It's a from Finland. And it's a you know, Nazis versus a gold digger, you know. Uh-huh. On the scorched earth of Finland during World War II. Uh-huh. The Nazis are in retreat. And it's probably a famous Finnish director whose work I've seen elsewhere, but I can't remember his name. The movie's called something like Sisu or something.
Oh, yeah, Sisu, yeah.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, but
well, listen, it's like Tarantino and Sergio Leone had an illegitimate a Scandinavian baby. It's extraordinary. And it's uber violent, but it's exactly what you just said, Mick. It's red humor. It has this red humor in it that's just so strange, even though it's like a graphic novel, boys' adventure, World War II, violent film.
Yeah. Well, you went from working with Toby on Eaten Alive soon after you were on V, which was a huge success, and suddenly you're recognizable as a running character in this miniseries that was such a huge success. So that was on television and therefore reached a vast audience that an independent or even studio film doesn't reach. So was that the first experience of you being recognized on a regular basis?
people have been buying me drinks since 1974.
Okay.
Because I do have a unique face.
Yes.
And I've done a wide spectrum of stuff. You know, people might see me in a little part in a Barbra Streisand movie, or in a big part with Henry Fonda, you know, or, you know, in a fight scene with Charles Bronson, or, you know, they don't, and they would send me a beer. No one ever knew my name until I did V. And then here's what happened, man. And they don't teach you this in film school. There should be a class just called working internationally or learning how to at least take advantage of having an international success. Sometimes you have a movie that's not a big hit in America. It's a hit overseas, or it's a hit in Japan, or it's much bigger there, or it lasts longer. Overnight, everybody in America and all over the world learned my name from V. And a year later, I did Nightmare on Elm Street, right. And it was international. So it was like a 1-2 punch, science fiction on everybody's television in their living room, and then horror at the number one international hit movie, back to back, 1-2 punch. And it's when they learn your name and you're international, it just changes your life. I mean, I could tell you, and you've been around the world and you know how much fun it can be and wonderful at getting someone to tell you about some project you've done and that they love, you know, I think your stand is the best stand ever. And you know, it's like some kid from Russia comes up to you, you know, or some girl in Milan. And that's when you know you've arrived, when you taste that international audience, and then you start working internationally. And that's also a lot of fun. You know, it has its ups and downs, and it has its pros and cons. But that's what happened for me with V, is I became international almost overnight. It just changed my life.
Suddenly the press wants to talk to you. They all around the world, you're known.
And it's also film festivals. I mean, you know, you're on a film festival and you don't even know who he is yet. There's Javier Bardem, you know, or Guillermo del Toro, or you're at a film festival, you know, you're a judge with Christopher Lee and the guy that directed The Ring, you know. Or, you know, I remember I was in the French Alps once with the French Elvis, Johnny Halliday.
Yes.
Aja Argento John Landis. We were the jury, you know, French Elvis, Aja Argento and John Landis and I were the jury. And it was like insane, but the food was great.
I bet it was. Well, along comes A Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's a phenomenon. The movie is a hit when it comes out, but it only gets bigger with each of the sequels. They feed upon each other. It's an Ouroboros. It's a snake eating its tail. It just grows and grows. And so you're known specifically as Freddy. Now, having worked with Tony Perkins, who played Norman Bates in all the Psycho movies, and having made the fourth one, I know that he felt really limited by the success of that character. Did you ever feel that? Was there ever were you always appreciative of, my God, I've lucked into this role that has opened so many doors for me? Or was there ever a time where, I don't want to just be Freddy, I'm Robert Englund?
Well, you know, eventually Anthony Perkins did Catch 22 with Mike Nichols, The Trial with Orson Welles. He did that, a great Greek film, art films, and lots of other stuff.
Oh yeah, Wyler, every great.
Yes, I think even though he starred with Jane Fonda in Tall Story and one or two other things, he hadn't done a lot before Psycho.
Right.
And I actually had, I had this weird career in sort of three acts. You know, there's like a fat, you know, 12 years before Freddy. And then there's Freddy, which is a fat 10 years. And then there's a break where I'm doing movies all over the world. And then there's Freddy versus Jason. And then there's all the work since then, everything from cartoons to voiceovers to, you know, knocking off a couple of horror, little low budget horror movies a year. So, but I think with Anthony, who was a leading man, you know, he's a beautiful guy, and, you know, had this great physicality and charm. I think that's why he fought it a little bit, because Psycho was so huge and he was so identified with it. And some of the tricks that he used as Norman Bates, he had to be careful of, because if they did show up, any of the neuroses that he used as an actor, as Norman Bates, he had to be careful to always kind of keep those out of his performance. So it was just an extra burden to him. A lot of stars are allowed to retain those mannerisms, you know, and their mannerisms
makes them stars in the first place.
That makes them stars. Their mannerisms of charisma in many instances, whether it's Brad Pitt or Paul Newman or Tom Cruise, you know, George Clooney. We love those mannerisms, you know, and that's something we anticipate and wait for and applaud.
Well, Christopher
and I think, but I think Anthony, I think he chomped at the bit because he had to fight all those tricks that he used with Norman Bates. And I think he kind of felt that maybe he missed at the age after Norman Bates, maybe he missed. And, you know, only actors know the parts that they are rejected for, you know, and all actors, whether you're Tom Cruise, doesn't matter who you are, get told no. There's parts they didn't get along the way. We always hear about these things, or parts that people turned down, or Tom Selleck turned down Indiana Jones and stuff. You hear about this stuff. Or people didn't get roles. Huge actors didn't get roles and were rejected. And I think that that happened to him post-Psycho for a while. And then he did some stuff and he, you know, in Europe, and he did some smaller roles, and then he charmed his way back into Hollywood's good graces and was doing great work, you know, in later in his career. But that may have really, you know, because it's that thing where they always say it, you know. I know Wes used to hate, would always say after Wes's name, Wes Craven, Horrormeister, right. Wes Craven. He hated that.
Yeah.
And Wes loved horror and taught me to respect it and taught me to remember my childhood love of horror. You know, you were talking in your intro about Lon Chaney, and I had buried a whole memory as a child of going to my godfather's home and looking through all of his coffee table books. He was a distributor for Simon & Schuster, at one called The Movies, and looking at a two-page foldout of all of the different makeups that the Man of a Thousand Faces, Lon Chaney, had done. And Lon Chaney and Lon Chaney's name have been in my brain since the second grade, since I was 7 years old, because of those two pages. And I often wonder, did that burrowed memory somehow come out and help me and make it easy for me to say yes to Wes and the challenge of the makeup of playing Freddy? But Wes reminded me of a lot of that, reminded me of little Robbie England, who loved horror movies and loved Hammer films and mowed lawns and spent Saturday mornings trying to cajole a neighbor's mom into driving us all and to the Reseda movie theater.
Oh, Reseda drive-in.
For a double bill.
Yeah.
Chico's Bonbons. Oh my God. Or the Studio City, the Lorena in Studio City. I saw opening day of Forbidden Planet.
Wow.
We watched it three times in a row. We couldn't believe it, you know. Robbie the Robot, Anne Francis, Leslie Nielsen, you know, VistaVision, you know, everything you could ever, and that sound effects, you know, that soundtrack. Oh, incredible.
Amazing. Well, even Christopher Lee resented that Dracula was what people thought of him for, but Dracula was what allowed him to play the Wicker Man and the other things that he was.
Oh, Lord of the Rings, all of those.
All of that stuff.
I hung with Chris in Brussels, and I had lunch with him every day for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm talking two bottles of wine. I got dragged on the opera tour. I was with him when I watched him do opera scales. He had the most beautiful tweed jacket from Savile Row I've ever seen. His wife was very fond of Nancy and I because Nancy showed her where all the best chocolatiers were in Brussels. But it took me forever to get him to talk about any of that. And I have hanging up on the wall behind me here an original black and white hammer still with the upside down girl with blood in her cleavage, and Christopher signed it to me.
Yeah, but Horror of Dracula.
He talked about, he would tell me every, but when he found out I was, the same thing happened with Henry Fonda. They found out, and I talk theater really well, and they found out I was from the theater, and we would be talking about great plays and stuff. And that's when both Christopher Lee and Henry Fonda opened up to me and started to share stories and started to tell stories pro and con about Hammer and stuff.
Well, let's talk about Hollywood Dreams and Nightmares, because you've written an autobiography that was incredibly well received and beautifully done. And now, you know, we're coming full circle. You still have a strong career going and you can pick and choose the roles, really strong voiceover career going in superhero animation and things like that. But now the story is about you. You're the center, and it's a history not only of your life, but of your work. And tell me how that feels.
Well, it's, I think of it as a story about this actor named Robert Englund, who survived over 50 years in Hollywood. And the dreams and nightmares are the hills and valleys. You know, the dreams and nightmares, you know, and got real lucky in his second act, you know, very fortunate with a huge horror franchise. And was wise enough, because he'd been around for 12, 15 years, was wise enough to go with the flow and to recognize and to respect the genre and what it represents. And nobody else was stepping up then, so I did.
What did open your eyes?
But when I took the makeup off after 10 years, I'd aged, and I started getting offered roles in the genre, but they were the old priest, you know, or a scientist, you know, or a doctor, and or the, you know, or the guy that tells the backstory. And I, and right, as I've aged, I can still play those roles. I've got one coming out, but it's that would have never happened had I tried to continue to play the sidekicks and the best friends, because those roles, starting in the mid 70s. Did not age well. They aged out. Back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, you had Walter Brennan and Arthur O'Connell playing sidekicks to John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart, you know, and they could have an old buddy, an old guy, an old alcoholic, or an old guy that was their buddy that they were helping out and taking care of, and he helped them out, you know, as a private eye or something. Whereas I would not have aged into those roles. Those roles don't exist anymore. Something changed. The Western went away. Lots of things happened. So I remained loyal because I saw that happening. I remained loyal to the genre. And because, and this is just pure serendipity, because I was working a lot in Europe. And it's just such fun to go for 2 months or 3 months to, you know, to Budapest, you know, or to Rome or somewhere like that. It's just a great adventure. For an actor in his 30s or early 40s. And so when I talk about Hollywood Dreams and Nightmares, I think it's just the sort of wisdom I have now in hindsight that I can impart and share about surviving all those years. And one of the things I can share is I was loyal to the genre, and it was the smartest thing, you know, that I could have done. But I also remember one day just, you know, I'll be at a convention, you know, Mick, and somebody will bring up a photo of me and Jamie Lee Curtis on Nancy Drew, or they'll bring a photo of me and James Earl Jones in some guest star role. I've completely forgotten about these things, but that stuff adds up. And there's an accumulation of that. And you realize, geez, I've worked with I've worked with a lot of people. I mean, I've worked with Lillian Gish. You know, wow. So I'm 6 degrees of separation from D.W. Griffith and Charlie Chaplin, you know, and Mary Pickford. I can play that game, you know, and And there's these adventures along the way, you know, getting drunk and sharing World War II stories with Jack Warden, me and Richard Thomas on location in the French Quarter, you know. And over the year, those things, you know, they layer. And you look back and it's like, I like sharing them. But this isn't a movie about, a documentary about my talent. I'm a working actor and I'm proud of that. I'm a character actor. I'm proud, but it's about a guy that survived for 50 years. And I learned to live with the rejection that we all have to deal with too. I mean, I've been up for, you know, people always talk about the reason I try to keep the Luke Skywalker thing, because I wasn't up for Luke Skywalker. I wasn't up for Hansel. I was up for March for Die with Gene Hackman. Which, yeah, I thought was going to be the biggest movie in the world. You remember that movie?
Yeah, Dick Richards.
Nobody knows what I'm talking about anymore. Yeah. I was up for The Last Detail, you know, for a minute. And Randy Quaid was brilliant in it. But, yeah, I mean, that broke my heart. You know, I couldn't eat for a week. That was such a disappointment for me. And years later, I ran into Daryl Ponickson at an art movie. And there was nobody in the theater but he and I. It was John Huston's Fat City.
Oh, good.
And we talked about it during intermission, and he told me what a fan he was of me and literally wrote about me the next day in the Herald Examiner. Where the hell was he at my audition? Daryl, you wrote the book. But I have a lot of those. I can talk about weird stuff. I mean, I had a bucket load of callbacks for, you know, Dukes of Hazzard. Who would I be if I had wound up on that show? And I was up for the original Kojak. One of the parts on that was originally an Irish street punk who, wow, was sort of like a stoolie, you know, kind of an informer for Telly Savalas. And they changed the role, made him a cop, and I didn't get the part. But those were big deals in a young actor's life. And, you know, that seasons you and it makes you tougher, you know. And, you know, there's still stuff like that I have to just, you know, my wife's constantly scolding me. She says, forget about it. It's over. It was 20 years ago.
Well, we are all, you know, so
it happens. And we all have to. I figure if it happened to me, imagine the secrets Tom Cruise has about early in his career, or people like that about people that told him no, you know?
Well, we're also grateful for the trajectory of your career, because you did end up as an icon of a genre that people embrace, that they feel the movies are their own. They want to own them. They have conventions, they have festivals where they show their love and appreciation. Our genre is the one that sticks most deeply in the hearts of the fans.
I think it's replaced so many now. You know, horror has always been around. There's a silent film, Frankenstein, and of course Nosferatu. But I think it's just survived for so long and it's gone in so many directions. You know, we have so many different recipes now in horror, you know, and it's in this constant evolution. And I'm proud of that, but I think people now, both intellectually and just heartfelt, sense that and realize that it's existed now over 100 years and it's still part and parcel. And every week there's a new horror film. And I think the great thing about the internet now and about streaming is these beautiful little great films that, you know, might get lost in the shadow of a superhero movie or a Marvel film, they do get discovered now. You know, people do find them, whether they go to the horror menu on Netflix or Prime Video or Apple TV, they do find them. They can go deep down that rabbit hole of horror, and they see something interesting. They can watch that free trailer, and I love the way horror is reinventing itself. I wouldn't want to live in a world without Jordan Peele. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Oh, Robert, thank you so much for sharing this time with us. The movie's great. I'm so proud that I was actually asked to be interviewed in the documentary.
I was so surprised. I had no idea which of my colleagues and old friends were asked to say things or come in to sort of support stories that I've told. And you were very kind, Mick.
Well, what a great opportunity to pay tribute to a good friend and a great.
Well, that's because I wasn't in the stand, punk.
next time.
All right, I Robert. Never forget. That little dog.
And that elephant. Your little dog, too.
Yes. Thank you, Mick.
Thanks. It was really great to see
All
you.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.